listening to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline. I'm your host, Monica Hadley, and with me is my co-host and mother, Caroline Kilborn. Is it raining over there where you are today, Mom?
Off and on. But yesterday, gully washers yesterday.
Definitely. I love these summer rains, though, because it just refreshes everything.
Well, yeah, maybe got rid of some of the pollen that's floating around.
That would be good, too.
Yes, yes.
So today we're tackling a pretty interesting topic.
Oh, my gosh.
Creativity.
Interesting and, you have to delve into a lot of things here.
So, Mom, you want to introduce our guest?
And how does he pronounce his last name?
Gannett.
Well, Alan, I'm very happy to be able to talk to you today. And Alan Gannett is the founder and CEO of Track Maven, a marketing analytics firm whose clients have included Microsoft, Marriott, Saks Fifth Avenue, Home Depot, Aetna, Honda, and GE. He has been on the 30 under 30 list for both Inc. and Forbes. And you have quite a variety of clients. I mean, that's very impressive.
We try and keep it eclectic.
And are you still under 30?
I'm still under 30. I just turned 12.
Yeah, you look like you just turned 12. Really, I'm kidding. I said to Monica, he looks like a teenager.
And I said, well, I don't
think
he's
the dermatologist is well paid.
So the title of Alan's book is The Creative Curve, How to Develop the Right Idea at the Right Time. Alan, given your background in data and analyzing data, what drew you to writing a book about creativity?
Yeah, so it's so interesting to me. You know, in our culture, one thing I didn't realize was how clearly we view creativity as a fixed thing. And, you know, my job has always been this sort of intersection of right brain, left brain. So I've been running this company for the last 6 years that helps marketers find patterns in their own marketing data and see what works and doesn't work. And so we've always been about applying sort of rationality and systems to a creative field. And I always sort of had this notion of creativity this way. I think, you know, I'd read books, I had read some of the science, I'd always just sort of thought about creativity as this thing that's, you know, you can change and get better at. But what I've realized over the last few years running my company is that, no, we have this very strong notion that creativity in our culture is something that it's a have or have not situation. I've heard lots of my customers who would say things like, well, I'm just not that creative. I have to hire a consultant. I have to do this. And what I realized was that, you know, people just feel like they're not that creative. And so, you know, that's really where the idea for the book came from, was sort of out of this frustration, out of this feeling of, okay, how do we get people to stop feeling these things?
You know, it's interesting that I've always sort of observed that there's a divide in our culture between creatives and everybody else. And it's both from people feeling like, well, I'm not creative, but also sometimes I've noticed people who think they are creative sort of lord that over other people.
Totally. Well, I think we have, in terms of the values that we've sort of conditioned into our culture, we've conditioned that certain things are better than others, and conditioned that, you know, there's some people who are born with this creative ability, and that's special and divine. And, you know, this comes from, I mean, you just think about all the movies and, you know, biopics and all these things we've seen that sort of revere these creative geniuses as something semi-divine. I mean, Mozart's one of the best examples of this. Mozart,
yes.
If you watch the movie Amadeus, he's like, you know, literally 3 years old, blindfolded, playing the piano for the Pope. Like, that's the opening scene. And
it's amazing. It's amazing.
Yeah. And the reality, though, is that Mozart, when he was 3 years old, had essentially what we would call a helicopter dad. And his helicopter dad said, little Mozart, I love you, but, which you should never say to a child, I love you, but you need to become a great musician. And little Mozart was like, whatever you say, Dad. And Mozart's dad hired for him the best music teachers in all of Europe and made this little kid practice 3 hours every single day, 7 days a week.
Oh,
and then he didn't write his original music when he was 4 or 6, like the legend has it. He wrote his first piece of original music when he was 17. And you may go, well, that's pretty impressive. Except one, it's like not a very good concerto. And two, this is after 14 years of practicing 3 hours every single day with the best music teachers in all of Europe under the conditional love of a helicopter dad. So, like, these notions we have of these creators as these mystical things are really just sort of historical games of telephone, but they very deeply impacted how we think about creativity and how we sort of view ourselves and how we view others in our culture.
That's right. That's right. Well, and these myths take on a life of their own.
Oh, yeah. I mean, Mozart, I think, is the funniest because there's this idea that he would compose music in his head. And this comes from a letter that was published in 1815 in a music magazine that was from Mozart describing his composition process. And the thing is, the letter was literally like hashtag fake news. It was forged by the music magazine publisher of the time because he wanted to sell copies. And so this letter has become like a huge part of how we think about Mozart, but it's literally a lie. And so we have these sort of fanciful notions of creativity that I think create a lot of negative impact on our society because it creates a lot of people who, A, either feel like they have something to lord over other people or people who feel like they can't, even though they can if they have the right mindset.
Mm-hmm.
Now, how did you find out about this letter being a forgery? I mean, how did you – this? You must have taken a tremendous amount of delving into things to find out these bits and pieces.
To debunk these myths.
Yeah, so one of the things I think is so interesting is actually that we've been studying creativity for the last 40 years across neuroscience, psychology, anthropology, sociology. It's actually a very well-studied field, but the research has mostly stayed sort of within the academic sphere. And one of my goals of the book is it's not actually covering much, from my perspective, new ground. I think it's new ground for people. Like, I think people aren't familiar with this stuff, but the research, the truth behind a lot of stuff has been well covered. I mean, one of the famous stories of sort of creative genius is Paul McCartney waking up from a dream mm-hmm. with the melody for Yesterday in his head. This is a, you know, told and retold story. And there are literally multiple books about this story, academic books sort of interrogating the story and looking at it and, you know, studying it. So we actually have a lot of people who for years have studied this stuff. And the goal of the book was really to sort of write a creativity 101 course that's very accessible. And so the first half of the book is sort of like a myth busting, here's the science and history of creativity, but like the truth. And the second half of the book, I interviewed about 25 living creative greats. So everyone from, you know, songwriting duo Pasek and Paul, who did Greatest Showman, La La Land, and Dear Evan Hansen, Jose Andres, the Michelin star chef, Kenya Barris, the creator of Black-ish, Bretta Chapman, the first woman to win the Academy Award for Best Animated Film, Nina Jacobson, the producer behind The Hunger Games and American Crime Story. And you know, what I wanted to do from these interviews was actually describe, well, okay, if what the science shows us is that creativity is something you get better at, well, then how do you do it? And so from these interviews, I lay out 4 things that you can actually do to actually get better at your creativity based on those interviews. And so the book is meant to be accessible. It's meant to be, you know, a sort of an easy way to sort of consume the last 40 years of sort of knowledge around creativity and creativity science.
So you do get into the neuroscience aspect of it, too. Why our brains do certain things and why it's so easy to believe the myth of creativity as divine inspiration and you get this, you know, flash that's from, you know, who knows where. But it really was your brain working on things sometimes for a long time without you even knowing it.
Totally.
But
yeah, so
yeah.
this is one of the things that people, when you talk, start talking about creativity as a process or as a system, one of the buts you get is, but what about aha moments, right? What about sometimes you just have that inspiration? It's just, it's sudden. It comes out of nowhere. And I think this represents a sort of tendency we have as people, which is that when things don't have a clear explanation or reason, we sometimes just ascribe them to magic or, you know, beyond our sort of ability to understand, and that's just not true. I mean, basically, aha moments are actually a very normal biological process, and you experience them in other places and you don't think they're as magical. Sometimes when you're looking at a crossword puzzle, sometimes you solve it by letter, step by step. It's logical processing. And sometimes you solve it all at once. You're like, oh, I got the answer. I know it. You just look at it and you get it. You have that sudden insight. And that actually, from a biological perspective, is the same thing as those flashes of genius we talk about these creatives having. And so scientists actually have a really good understanding of what's going on in the brain when you experience these aha moments, because they basically will put people in MRI machines and show them different word puzzles and see, like, what's going on in the brain when people experience sudden insight versus logical processing. And the short version of it is that sudden insight happens in our right hemisphere. And our right hemisphere is where we store the more, like, sort of like definition two of concepts. Like, you know, the distant ideas, metaphors, wordplay, puns, those are all going in your right hemisphere. And your right hemisphere's job is to connect sort of different and disparate ideas together, divergent thinking. But it does this all below the level of consciousness. It's only once an answer comes together that it actually pops into consciousness, hence the aha. And so this magical experience we talk about of, oh, this idea just came to us, well, it's not magical. It's just how our right hemisphere processes information. The analogy I like to give is that your left hemisphere is like that loud lab partner in college who's like, you know, he's smart, but he's bro-y. He's the captain of the lacrosse team, and he's you know, talks about every step. He's like, let's do this, and then this, and then this, and look, we got the answer. And your right hemisphere is the sort of dorky, quiet, but smart lab partner, and, you know, he's looking at it. He's like, okay, let's do this, and then this, and this, and hey, we got the answer. And if the loud lab partner is too loud, you can't hear your right hemisphere. And so this is why you experience these aha moments in the shower or when you're running or meditating, is that you actually have to have your left hemisphere, your loud lab partner, kind of be quiet. And so these aha moments, we know a lot about how they work and why they work. And one of the things I talk about in the book is that the thing that scientists say is most important to having more aha moments, other than making time for peace and quiet, the most important thing is to have prior knowledge, is to actually have dots to connect, to have the electricity for your light bulb moments. You need to actually have ideas in your right hemisphere if you want your right hemisphere to do work. And so, you know, we talk about Paul McCartney having these epiphanies, but the reality is he had, you know, played in a cover band for years. He grew up in a musical household. You know, J.K. Rowling, we talk about being hit with the idea for Harry Potter, but, you know, we forget that she grew up in this household where she would, to get away from her parents fighting, she would close the door and read books and books and books and books. And college, she had all these library finds. She had so many books out. And so the things that were percolating in their right hemisphere were not, you know, nothing. It was music. It was books. It was characters. So when they have aha moments, those are the things they dream about. Those are the things they connect. That's not shocking. That's not magic. That's actually pretty logical.
You know, I've always been puzzled about sometimes new writers, you know, most writers, as you mentioned in your book, are voracious readers. But occasionally I run into somebody who says, well, I don't want to read anything in, like, in the, you know, that's at all similar to what I'm writing. Like if they're writing fantasy, I don't want to read anything because I want to be original.
Well, and this is one of the things I think is so interesting about the difference between aspiring creators and creative achievers. So aspiring creators have these notions of creativity and they tend to intertwine it a lot with originality, with newness. But the best creators actually know that people don't like radically new ideas. People like ideas that have one foot in the familiar and one foot in the novel. They're ideas that feel similar and familiar and comfortable, but have a novel twist. I mean, you know, Harry Potter, just use that as an example. That is literally the most straightforward rags-to-riches orphan rising story of all time. But there's monsters and magicians and wizards, and it's this whole novel twist on the story. And that's what makes it fun and interesting. We know when we're reading Harry Potter from book one, page one, that it's going to end happily ever after. And that's part of the sort of contract the writer has with the reader. And you see this over and over again with these great novelists. They are very comfortable with the idea that they're creating their own novel twist, pun intended, on a concept that's been done before. I mean, Kurt Vonnegut, famously, when he was younger, tried to get a master's degree in anthropology, which he didn't complete because he said, quote, "I didn't realize how stupid primitive people were," unquote. And he, for his thesis, he literally went and mapped out the emotional arcs of stories, of great novels, and he found four recurring patterns. And this was a foundational experience for him. And so I think this is one of these big sort of misunderstandings people have. People think creativity is about creating radical newness, but you wouldn't want something that's radically new. You wouldn't want to watch an 8-hour movie with no protagonist. Like, ugh. And so it actually turns out that, I talk in the book about some of the science around this, but it actually turns out as people, the ideas that we like, the ideas we prefer, and the ideas that the great creators are very good at doing are the ideas that are familiar enough to feel safe, but novel enough to be interesting, novel enough to be intriguing. And so it's not about radical newness. It's about blending newness with the familiar.
You're listening to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is Alan Gannett, author of The Creative Curve.
And also, you talk about the importance of creativity having value.
Yeah, so, you know, sometimes when people talk about creativity, they talk about it almost in, you know, opposition to the idea of recognition or commercial viability or any of this stuff. And the issue is that there's two types of creativity. Academics call it little c creativity, which I think is a really cute name. Little c creativity, which is just the creation of something. You're just physically creating something. And then there's uppercase C creativity. And this is what we actually all want. This is the creation of something that's both new and valuable, new and valuable. And that is so important because that's what, when we're doing stuff, when we're doing creative acts, unless we're being very gratuitous, that's what we're aiming to do. We're aiming to create things that resonate with people, that create an impact on an audience, big or small. But it turns out that capital C creativity is all about creating something that, at least for some group of people, it can be a huge group, it can be mainstream, it can be a small group, but for some group of people, they recognize it, they find value in it. And this is why you find that the best creators are also very active at listening to their audience, at getting feedback, at thinking and putting them their shoes in the audience, because they're not actually creating for themselves. I think this sort of meme around, oh, I create for myself, I think that's a crutch. I think that is something that we tell ourselves when no one likes our creativity. I think the reality is that creators are creating for people to experience an emotion, a reaction of something. And so I think if you try and disintermediate recognition from creativity, you're doing yourself a disservice.
Now, what about people who were, you know, very creative people throughout history who weren't recognized or valued during their own lifetimes, but were at some later point? Do you have an explanation for that?
Yeah, this is a great question. So there's a bunch of different things that I think go on. So one is that one of the things you notice and is that technical skill and being deemed creative are actually two different things. And sometimes people get those mixed up. So you could be highly technically proficient, but not deemed creative and not maybe even actually be creative. And you see this a lot with things like simultaneous invention, where two people create the same idea in the same year or the same month or the same day, but yet only one of them gets deemed creative because of all these social reasons. Like, you know, Charles Darwin and Alfred Wallace are a great example of this, where Alfred Wallace created the idea of natural selection at the same time, but, you know, we all think of evolution as Darwinism, and we don't even remember who Alfred Wallace is. They tried to create a statue for him in Britain, and they couldn't raise money for it, and this is a guy who's, you know, a huge foundational part of science. And so you see this sort of recognition element's actually really, really important, but sometimes later things do get recognized. And, you know, my honest answer is that I think a lot of that has to often be luck. I think what you often find is people who are recognized later in life typically are recognized for a more narrow set of things, like, you know, Moby Dick, it's one book. And so I think what you find is that a lot of times the type of creativity that I'm most interested in is the people who are able to do it again and again and again, who seemingly book after book, hit after hit, they're able to do this. And the reason why I'm so interested in that is that there's something more at work there. It's not just a luck thing. It's not just about, you know, the stars coming to alignment, but there's some skill that underlies why this person's able to create, you know, 10, 15, 20 years of, you know, creative recognition.
Well, what part of it may be, you know, in your book, you talk about the four step, you know, the four things that are required for creativity. And one of them is creative communities. And an important aspect, I believe, and that an aspect of that had to do with someone who would promote you.
Totally. So what, one of the things I talk about in the book is this idea of a prominent promoter, where since creativity and recognition are so intertwined, what you find is that the successful creative often we're latched up to someone else who already has reputation, already has credibility. So in academia, you see this where when they do studies, they find that future Nobel laureates appear in their 20s to be twice as productive as similar scientists with similar pedigrees who don't go on to win Nobel Prizes. But the reality is they actually weren't twice as productive. They just happened to work for senior researchers who let them put their names on their papers. And so what you find is that this over time leads to a compounding advantage where they're cited more in their 30s, they have more reputation, and it's hard to catch up if you're not one of those people. You see this in the music industry with, you know, people have opening acts. So they have, you know, younger musicians or earlier musicians come and open for them. And this is a way of passing on the reputation. But without those experiences, it can be very hard to actually have someone give you the time of day to be recognized, and if recognition and capital C creativity are intertwined, well, that makes it very difficult. So you find that having a promoter in your life is very important. This is why you see that so many creatives intertwine themselves in a community of other creatives where the promoters exist. I mean a community both physically and socially, right? So they often move to certain cities. You know, you think about the beat poets all living, you know, somewhat near each other. This is part of the creative process. Part of the creative process is the social dynamics of it, not just the, you know, going to a writing cabin and writing a book.
And look at, you know, at Paris in the after World War One, Hemingway,
oh, totally.
And Fitzgerald, and on and on and on, the artists and the writers and the and it, you know, I've been reading a book recently about Hemingway called We All Behave Badly, you know, the people, Gertrude Stein, if she took someone under her wing, they had a much better shot of making it. And she would introduce it to other people who would, you know, the promoters were so important to the success of those writers
100%.
And artists.
And, yeah, and it gets the ball rolling.
Yeah. And that also kind of can explain why, you know, sometimes we look at historically that that so many of the top creative people were white males.
Oh, totally. Stale, pale, and male.
Yeah. But is it, and so, you know, some people will look at that and say, well, men, white men just are more talented. Look at everything they've done.
No, not at all. I mean, the thing you see, the reality is what happens is that since people like to mentor people like themselves, you actually find that creative fields are actually some of the most have the most structural inequality. Think about how male Hollywood is and how hard it's been for women to break into that. I mean, it's just it, and you see this obviously with the Me Too movement and all the stuff that's now coming out, is that a lot of these industries we think of as very progressive are actually like very not progressive.
Right, and well, Oscar's so white.
Yes, totally. Totally.
And there have been women and people of color doing amazing work throughout history that just didn't get the recognition because they weren't part of the in group.
100%. And that's terrible, right? And that's one of the things that I think you're starting to see people realize and change and just be more intentional about who they mentor and who they bring in. And, you know, typically I talk about in the book that, you know, a lot of these great creative jobs are apprenticeship models where you start in the mailroom making, you know, $13 an hour, and if you're poor, you can't afford that. And so what you see is that the well-connected, you know, Ivy League educated kids with rich parents, they're the ones who can afford their kids to be, you know, mailroom assistants at the talent agency and end up becoming talent agents. And so I think you're starting to see people change that, but you really do have a sourcing problem that's really important.
Absolutely. You're listening to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is Alan Gannett, author of The Creative Curve. So, Alan, would you like to read for our audience from The Creative Curve?
Sure. I have a section that I think is kind of fun on I spent a day with the flavor team at Ben and Jerry's. And let me read from that, and hopefully no one's too hungry. So here we go. Chapter 10, Law 4, Iterations. I'm sitting in a conference room named Chubby Hubby at the world headquarters of Ben & Jerry's in Burlington, Vermont, a room that, like many of the conference rooms here, is named after one of the company's best-known ice cream flavors. My trip to this quirky state has so far lived up to my expectations. The gift shop at the hotel where I was staying sold both Ben & Jerry's ice cream and Vermont maple syrup. I saw electric cars everywhere on the city streets. In Ben & Jerry's parking lot, there was even a Ben & Jerry's branded Tesla. The office was designed back in 1996, yet it has the feel of a Silicon Valley startup. Long before Google and Facebook, Ben & Jerry's built an iconoclastic culture. Dogs are welcome to the office. My visit was punctuated by periodic barks. And a massive red slide by the main entrance transports employees from the second floor conference room down to the first. In addition, there's a huge gym, which helps to counteract the quote, Ben 10, a yoga room, and a private nursing room named the Milky Way. I'd come to Vermont to spend the day observing the Ben & Jerry's creative process. I grew up in a household where their ice cream was more than just a dessert. For my mother, after a long day at work, it was therapy, a way to unwind. As I made my way around the building, I couldn't help noticing empty pints of ice cream everywhere on every desk. Employees collected the flavors they worked on as sort of a cardboard trophy wall. Ben & Jerry's has had so many flavors that I assumed the process for creating new one was by now efficient and direct. A food scientist would come up with a flavor idea, churn up a batch of the concoction, sample it, then supply an all-important verdict of thumbs up or thumbs down. There would assuredly be consultation with other teams, but otherwise, the process would be straightforward. Begin with the delicious ice cream base, add some cookies, throw in some caramel, and voila, another new flavor takes its place in the Ben & Jerry's roster. Instead, I found out that making new ice cream is serious business at Ben & Jerry's. I spent all day learning the 4 steps that Ben & Jerry's uses to create the ideal new flavor. And as we'll discuss, I can't help but realize that this same process is used not just for making ice cream, but for other types of creative endeavors I witnessed. The company's first store, which the founders opened in 1978, was a retrofitted gas station in Burlington. Jerry Greenfield, the Jerry of Ben & Jerry's, explained to me that in many ways the venture was born of necessity. Ben and I started the ice cream shop because we wanted to work together, do something fun, because we always liked to eat, and because we were failing at the other things we were trying to do. They had taken a $5 remote education class in how to make ice cream, and armed with their newfound expertise, they decided to open up shop. In no time at all, they were a local phenomenon. Today, the company founded by two Burlington hippies is known around the world for its decadently rich flavors, including Chunky Monkey, my mother's favorite, Cherry Garcia, and fish food. Jerry's all-time favorite is the now discontinued coconut almond fudge chip. He recalled to me, it was like a trip to a tropical beach for the mind and the taste buds. But what I want to know was how the brand comes up with their flavors, and while we're on the subject, who comes up with them? Every year, Ben & Jerry's launches 6 to 12 new flavors. This means they are under continual pressure to create new products that land at the right point of the creative curve. But how had they operationalized this within their business? It turns out they had devised a repeatable system for achieving the vaunted sweet spot, pun very much intended, of familiarity and novelty. When I probed more deeply, I was introduced to a few individuals who may have the best job in America, the Ben & Jerry's flavor gurus.
Oh, boy.
Thanks, Alan. So what I'm really curious about, 6 to 12 new flavors, do they retire that many every year, or do only like one or two of them stick?
Yeah, so they actually retire a whole bunch of flavors every year, and they literally have in the grounds of the factory, they have the flavor graveyard, where they literally have these tombstones, of course made of Vermont granite, of the old flavors. And so you can see the flavors, and there's some sad ones there that you probably wish were real, like they have, for example, popcorn and M&Ms, which unfortunately failed because when popcorn stays in ice cream, it gets soggy, they found out. But it took them actually making the flavor to discover that.
Wow. Well, okay. But most of the flavors, when I go and look at the ice cream case of Ben & Jerry's, most of the flavors that are there are ones that have been there for a long time. I think Chunky Monkey and Cherry Garcia and American Dream Cone, and although maybe I'm out of date, but I don't notice that many new ones.
Yeah, no, I think we need to get Mom, maybe you can help me here. We need to get you to eat more ice cream. There's about 36 or 48 Ben & Jerry's flavors on the shelf. And then they also have in the scoop shops, they have even more. They do seasonal flavors and all sorts of stuff.
Okay.
Probably healthy that you aren't a huge Ben & Jerry's eater. This is probably a good thing.
Well, I love Ben & Jerry's, but when I get a pint, because it's so good, I can eat – a pint can last me about 10 servings.
That's a very, very healthy thing.
Yeah.
We are glad for this.
And also, I don't think my grocery store carries them all. That's probably the thing. Yeah.
Yeah. My grocery store has a very large ice cream section. I'm just going to walk myself out here.
So, Alan, one of the things I was wondering is, how did you decide who to interview for this book? Because you have such a wide variation of creative people, from chefs to romance novelists to TV, creators to songwriters to professors, even a congressman.
Yeah, I mean, basically the thing that I was looking for was people who were able to create hits multiple times. So, you know, I think One Hit Wonders is probably an interesting book sort of tied to those people, but they're not the ones that I want to learn from, right? Because to me, that seems like, well, it could just be sort of, broken clocks strikes the right time twice or whatever the saying is. And so for me, what was really interesting is, who are these people who over their careers have been able to create hit after hit in different time periods, some in very different industries? Like, those people are particularly interesting to me. And, what did they do? Because there must be something there, right? If you're able to have a 20, 30-year career in a creative field, like, it's not just luck.
Right, right. And how did you narrow in, find those people? What was your research, or were these just people that you knew of from your work previously?
So, no, what I did was I created lists of the different categories I wanted. Like, for example, I wanted a stand-up comedian, I wanted tech entrepreneur, I wanted writers. And so I basically created these different lists. And then I basically had a research assistant who helped me pull lots and lots of lists online of sort of top, you know, blanks, so top romance writers, top chefs, sort of et cetera, et cetera. And then try and find people across all of those different lists and trying to also account for certain things like have as much gender balance as possible, you know, stuff like that. And so basically sort of taking this macro approach. And then once I had the list of potentials, reaching out to people, sometimes cold, sometimes through, I found there was mutual connections and just, you know, I probably tried to interview hundreds of people and ended up with 25 that I feel good with, representative of sort of a pretty broad set of sort of industry and perspectives and geographies. You know, there's people I'm interviewing from the middle of the country and all sorts of different places. And so I feel like I got the sort of pretty good sort of horizontal set. One of the things that is interesting, though, when you're doing work on creative fields, and especially when you're trying to be pretty genre agnostic, you know, trying to go between chefs and writers, so to speak, it's amazing how so many of these creative industries are so undiverse. And that was one of the things I sort of struggled with.
Yeah.
And, you know, you find that creative industries, it turns out, are actually some of the least progressive when it comes to diversity, because there's a social dynamic to creativity where so much of successful creativity comes from being sort of sponsored by someone more senior who lends you their credibility. And so you end up, you know, people tend to mentor and sponsor people who remind them of themselves. And so you end up with this sort of structural inequality. And so I always thought that was interesting that Hollywood, for example, which you would think is very creative and progressive, is actually a pretty conservative culture, and it's pretty, you know, stale, pale and male, as they say. And so, I thought that was interesting. That was one of the things that stuck with me from the experience, is just, how undiverse a lot of these fields are.
Yeah, we talked a little bit about that earlier, but I don't think we can emphasize this point enough, that, you know, as a girl growing up, and you're reading history, you're looking at history, whether you're talking about art or you're talking about, you know, science or any field, creative and, I mean, in a sense, any field is creative. But there weren't a lot of women that you read about or that seem to have done things that were worth remembering hundreds of years later. And it's easy to think, well, And some people do have this attitude, well, women just weren't as talented. They weren't as smart. They weren't as talented. And ignore the fact that really they just didn't have the opportunities.
Correct. I mean, one of the best examples of this, I think, is Mary Shelley, the novelist who wrote Frankenstein when she was 20.
Yes.
And she, in order to get it published, had to publish it under her husband's name. Right? And
yeah.
It's like... And she went, the first edition was husband's name, second edition was just anonymous, and third edition, she actually put her name on it. But it's like, you know, that would have been a death blow to the novel. And that, I think, tells you, you know, all you need to know is that there is inherently, people don't just judge creative work by the merits. There's the entire sort of social dynamic and fabric around it, and that's a real thing.
You call that, in your book, you call that the gatekeepers, right?
Yeah. And what's interesting about, so the gatekeepers are the people who sort of signal to the rest of us, you know, what are things that are going to become part of the canon, part of the domain, part of the standards, part of what's well-regarded or not well-regarded. And what's interesting is historically, you know, the kind of concept of the gatekeepers seems sort of obvious. And, you know, it's the record label executives, all that stuff. But it's actually, what's interesting is, you know, the internet is making it more democratic. But it's not like a total democracy still. I mean, you know, Spotify has definitely made things more democratic for independent musicians, but now the gatekeepers are the Spotify playlist curators. And, you know, now you think about ebooks and Kindle, and sure, it's more democratic if you want to become a writer, but there are still gatekeepers. You still need to get that right blogger to review your novel. You still need to get that right person to pay attention. And so the gatekeepers are becoming more diffuse, but they're not going away.
And right. As a consumer of creative output, we rely on the gatekeepers because there's so much out there that you can't filter through it all by yourself.
100%. It would literally be, you would just never make decisions. And so
this is
why you see creatives do, there's all sorts of stuff, right? There's, you know, with books, there's the blurbs on the back of the book. It's a form of gatekeeper, sort of literally bestowing credibility onto something. You know, with musicians, there's opening acts. And so I think this is such an important part of creativity. It's part of where the structural equality comes from, but it's also part of where I think a lot of aspiring creatives get kind of messed up.
Right.
Where they're like, well, I poured my soul into this book. Why is anyone caring? And it's like, well, why should they care?
Right.
You have to help convince them. That's part of your job. And it's not fair. It's not right. Like, whatever you want to insert phrase here, but it is true.
Well, you know, for Writers' Voices, it is true that, I mean, we do self-published authors. We do interview self-published authors. But it is easier for me when a book comes from Penguin or, you know, a major publisher, because then I know that somebody else has actually read this book and thought it was worth something. And
oh, totally.
You know? And, yeah. And who's your publisher, by the way?
Penguin.
So there you go.
This is part of what was interesting for me. Writing a first book, I run a digital marketing startup, and so people are like, why didn't you self-publish? And I was like, well, sort of when you're writing a book in creativity, you sort of quickly realize that the social dynamics of creativity are pretty important. And so especially for a first book, having a mainstream publisher to me was important because I wanted people to have that momentary instance of saying, okay, let me take a look at this. And it's been very much true. But that to me is interesting, where that's this different from the quality of the work, right? That's a distinct thing. It's related to the quality of the work, but I could have written the same book without the help of the publisher. But that has opened a lot of doors when marketing it or selling it or even just, you know, distributing it, obviously.
Mm-hmm. Right. Because there's only so many hours in the day for the people who would buy or put your book on the shelf. And if it comes from a major publisher, again, they know that somebody else has done that curating process for them to know that there's some value there. Because a self-published book could be the best book in the world, or it could be total yuck.
Yeah. And it's interesting now, you see, I spend a bunch of time with Kristen Ashley, who's, depending on the year, the best-selling romance novelist. And, you know, she is so interesting. She started as the sort of ebook, I think the New York Times called it the ebook queen. And, you know, now she also has traditional published deals, and she does both. And I think it's just generally interesting seeing how the sort of the Kindle and the ebook movement has really reshaped writing. But it hasn't, I think, it hasn't completely destroyed the publishing industry, right? The publishing industry, you know, hardcover book sales are up. indie bookstore sales are up. And so I think generally we're getting to a moment where people are reading more again, which is good.
Yes.
But I don't think it's completely, you know, we're not starting from an entirely new place.
You know, we've talked to authors, some of whom started self-publishing because they either didn't want to spend the time to try and find an agent and a publisher, and then had some success with their books and moved to traditional publishers after they proved themselves in e-publishing. And then we've talked to authors that started with traditional publishers and moved to self-publishing because they built up a reputation with the traditional publishers that people would buy their books even if they weren't through a traditional publisher.
Totally.
So it goes both
directions. In my market, Seth Godin, who's a popular sort of marketing writer, he moved to sort of quasi self-publishing. He didn't imprint with Amazon because he had the reputation.
Right.
You know, he had the audience. He had a super popular blog. He had 600,000 Twitter followers. He was able to do that. And so, I mean, that's one of the things I think for creatives what's exciting about digital is that so much more than ever before, you're able to own your audience very literally, right? You own your email newsletter. And I think that's very exciting for creatives. That's a big sort of change in innovation and helps give creatives, I think, more power. And that's both more practical power, but also importantly, economic power.
Right.
And, you know, because if you have that option of, hey, well, I'll just self-publish. And if you have 500,000 people in your newsletter subscription base, like, you can do that and make a real living. So.
But, you know, I think you're right that with book publishing, we seem to have found a balance with e-publishing and traditional publishing that both can be very successful, and the traditional publishers and the traditional bookstores are healthy. They're not going away.
Yeah.
It seems like in music publishing, it's been a little trickier.
And music's interesting, though, because music is still going through sort of a transformation, but now you see that for some of the record labels, Spotify is the plurality of their revenue when it comes to recordings. And you see, you know, musicians have found new ways. Like, if you ever go to a concert now and you look at the ticket options, there's like 17, and one of them is like, you know, the VIP meet and greet, and there's another one's the VIP meet and greet plus photo, and there's all these new ways that people are learning to extract revenue. And I think that, to me, is what's interesting, is that these things are messy, and it takes a while to figure them out, but I think we are figuring them out. You know, you see this obviously with celebrities are now have, you know, iPhone apps that are super popular and making lots of money. And so I think things are changing, but I think sometimes we in creative fields tend to overestimate the fear of, you know, overestimate change and are too fearful of it. I mean, the reality is that, you know, people are always going to want creative products, and there's always going to be demand for them, and how we monetize it's a separate question. And, you know, obviously I think with books, we've started to figure it out pretty well,
right,
which is exciting.
Right. And we're also in some sense returning to, you know, going back a few centuries and returning to somewhat of a patronage model in some fields.
Oh yeah. Literally Patreon, right? I mean,
yeah.
It's become for those who don't know, it's a startup where you can fund your favorite creators with a subscription. So, you know, $1 to $100 a month. And depending on how much you give them, you get access to different special rewards every month. And, you know, a lot of digital creators do this, like YouTube creators, and they make a real living off it. And, you know, that to me is pretty cool and exciting, because that's giving power to the consumer and the creator. It's, you know, disintermediating these ad networks and some of these other, you know, platforms. And I think that's really cool and really exciting. And you're seeing now Facebook's experimenting with a Patreon competitor. And so I think you're going to see more and more interesting innovations like that.
You're listening to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline. And our guest today is Alan Gannett, author of The Creative Curve, How to Develop the Right Idea at the Right Time.
I was interested because you have so many different people and follow how they did things, like Darwin and Paul McCartney. I mean, you know, it isn't just people, it's famous people. And I'm just wondering how in the world you found out all these things.
So what was fun for me, part of the process of doing a book like this, is just, I mean, inherently you get to be very curious, and you get to spend a lot of time learning about a lot of things. And so, I mean, that's one of the things when people ask me about the book writing process, I always recommend it, because you get the time to focus on one topic, right? I mean, this book is about creativity, but since it's, you know, 3 years of research and interviews, I got to look at it from lots of different dimensions and different things and take my time with it. And so, you know, it really was a labor of time, more than anything else. And I think that was one of my lessons from just my own creative process was, you know, I look back into the different variations of the book over time, and God, the early versions were so bad. And so, and I think that to me is one of the chapters of the book is about iterations and about sort of how all writing is rewriting and all creative processes are in the sort of the fine tuning of it. And that to me was interesting, just experiencing that while writing a book about creativity.
Well, Alan, did you take any time off from your day job to write this?
I did. I took 1 week off the week that the manuscript was due, but otherwise this was basically my Sundays became writing days, and then some evenings and plane rides and stuff. But it took a while as a result. But it was fun. And, you know, I think it was one of the benefits of, you know, writing a book as a young guy with no kids. And, you know, this was my baby.
And are there going to be more children?
Hopefully. I mean, it was definitely really fun. I'm like, it's one of those things where I think I could probably use a break from writing for a while, because, you know, it's a lot of time. But yeah, I think definitely, again, I really am interested generally in human virtues and the things that we look at as virtuous, and how people, you know, get get better at them or learn them, because I think a lot of human virtues we think are fixed and are things we can't necessarily get better at. And so I think I wouldn't be surprised if book two is on another human virtue. So.
Another human virtue.
Ellen, do you think all of this would have been possible without the internet, without your use
no.
of the internet?
100% no. Not for me, at least. Not as a young author, right? Just because I think the internet sort of allows for access in ways that I wouldn't have had as a young person. Think about just the amount of people I emailed for interviews and cold emailed and was able to research and figure out who's their assistant and all this stuff and send them an email and be able to follow up over email. I mean, it would have been
amazing.
Impossible. I would have had to had a career that lasted 20 or 30 years before I'd be able to have enough of a network density to be able to write a book like this that has so many sort of people involved.
Did anyone that you approached for an interview turn you down?
Oh, yeah, 100%. I probably asked about 250 people to get about 25 interviews.
Wow.
Which I feel good about, like 10%. I was like, I feel good about that.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
it was a lot of no's or a lot of just like no responses.
Now, the book is kind of in two parts. One where you're talking kind of about the neuroscience of creativity, which is really fascinating, and you're using a lot of historical examples and current examples to illustrate that. You talk about different research studies, and then you go into kind of the prescription of how to do this, how to
mm-hmm.
find the sweet spot between familiarity and novelty. Can you talk a little bit about that four-step process and how you came up with it, how you defined it
that
way?
So basically what I did is in the interviews that I did, I found that there was these recurring patterns of things these creatives did to actually become, you know, more creative. And so I outlined those things. I call them the four laws of the creative curve, and I'll walk you through the four and sort of like in the brief version. So the first law is that of consumption. And so one of the things I talk about is that we think of these great creatives as doers, as always doing, as very active, almost in contrast to consumers. But actually, these great creatives are some of the biggest consumers of creative products in their niche. And I explain why that is and the neuroscience of why that is and why that's so important to building creative careers to actually be a overactive consumer. The second law is imitation. So we often talk about creativity as the province of newness, of innovation. But actually, when you look at the truth around creativity, it's actually about the blend of the familiar and the novel. And so I explain that the best way to create the right amount of familiarity is through imitation. And I don't mean plagiarism, but I mean imitating the structure of great successful work. And so I talk about that. I give examples like how Kurt Vonnegut did this and how some musicians do this and talk about that. The third law is that of creative communities. So we think of these creative geniuses as these solo operators. They're Steve Jobs, Elon Musk, you know, capital S, capital E. And the reality is that all of these creators all are part of creative communities. They all have lots of people around them. They do lots of stuff. There's a lot of different roles with the creative process that one person can't actually do. And so even though that's the sort of PR myth of creativity, I explain what the creative community you should have around you looks like and how to actually get that creative community. And the fourth law is iterations, and specifically data-driven iterations, where, you know, these great creatives really understand that, you know, they're not creating for themselves. I think that's something aspiring creatives say, but these great creatives know that they're creating for their audience. And as a result, they're very focused on listening to their audience and getting feedback early and often and then iterating on it. And so I talk about examples of this ranging from Ben & Jerry's, which you heard a little bit about, to the movie industry, to even I talk a little bit about politics. And so, so those four laws are four things that you can practically do to actually get better at the subtitle of the book, which is developing the right idea at the right time.
And at what point in your writing process had you defined those four laws?
Oh my God. Like, it was literally like the last, I mean, it was like, It was constantly changing and morphing up until probably a month before I submitted the manuscript, because, you know, the book process is pretty organic in terms of it's very iterative, right? And you're constantly consuming information and taking new inputs in, reframing them. And so it started to come together a year before, but then it took probably about 11 months of chewing on it and working on it to come up with the four. There was variations when there was 10, there's variations when there was 3, and eventually I found that These were four things that were universal. So all 25 of the creative geniuses I interviewed did them. So I felt very strongly about them. And then I also found that these are four that were, there's a lot of science explaining why they worked. And so I was able to feel very confident that these were four things that would stand up to any sort of, rigor.
And was it intentional that it's CICI, consumption, imitation, creative community, iteration?
No, but you're the first person to notice that. Oh, my God, Cece. Who's Cece? I have to talk to my therapist about this. Cece, oh, look at that. You're right. Oh, my God, I didn't even notice.
Well, I notice patterns.
That's good. That's important for creativity.
Right. Absolutely. I have learned that from your book. And I will tell you, Alan, that this is a book I'm going to keep.
Oh, yay. That makes me so happy.
Yeah, and refer back to, because I found the whole thing really fascinating.
Oh, there's
Thank
so
you very
much.
Much
in it. So much in it. Yeah.
Well, it's been a great pleasure having you on Writers' Voices. Do you have any final words of advice for the aspiring writers in our audience?
Oh my God, yes. The big thing I'd say to anyone who's aspiring to be a writer is, one, view it as a craft. You're going to get better at it, but it's going to take a huge amount of work. The second thing is there's a mindset shift that I think you need to do. And the mindset shift, I think, especially for writers, is so many writers talk about writer's block and being visited by inspiration and the muse and all this stuff. And the thing I can tell you is that if you just wait and you bang your head against the wall, you're not going to get there. What you find is that these great writers, and I talk about some in the book, ranging from, Kurt Vonnegut to people like Ben Franklin, who wrote this autobiography we still read today, they were not people who just banged their head against the wall. They were very thoughtful. They were methodical. They intentionally went about becoming better at their creative processes, and they didn't, chalk it all up to divine inspiration. And so if that's what you're waiting for, I think ultimately that is kind of actually an excuse.
Mm.
I think that's a way to avoid sometimes the hard work. And I think a lot of creatives, this is sort of subconscious or unconscious, but you find that I think as people, we sort of like homeostasis. We like, we don't like big radical shifts or change in our days or times, but you find these great creatives spend huge amounts of effort to become better. And that to me is actually an inspiring story because it's the story that anyone can do this, but it is also a story of hard work. And so I'm not arguing at all that it's easy just because I'm saying that there's some method to it. I'm just saying that there is some practicality to it, but it is incredibly difficult.
Well, thank you, Alan. And Mom, do you have some closing words of wisdom for us today?
Well, the thing is, he took the words right out of my mouth. Because I was going to use the last sentence of his book, which says, achieving your creative potential isn't for the faint of heart. It requires countless hours, days, and even years of work, but it's no longer a mystery.
Well, thank you, Alan. Thank you, Mom. And see you all next week on Writers' Voices.
Thank you, guys.
Bye-bye.